Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, an Arizona pastor advocates an extreme definition of Christian masculinity and a firsthand account of how President Trump's tariffs are reshaping a local bakery. But first, the U.S. and Mexico will meet next week to begin talks on the USMCA, the trade agreement that governs much of the economic relationship between the two countries, as well as Canada. The USMCA is one of the major reasons that trade with Mexico has remained relatively steady, in spite of the broader uncertainty created by President Trump's ill-fated tariff policy. But next week's meeting will put the agreement and the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Mexico under a microscope. Joining us now from Hermosillo to break this all down is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky. Nina, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Nina, the USMCA, which stands for United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, is a pretty significant treaty. Tell us what it is and why people in Arizona should be paying attention to these talks.
Yeah. So, you know, like you hinted to, the USMCA is this trade deal that binds the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. And the previous Trump administration, around 8 years ago, actually negotiated this deal to replace NAFTA. And like NAFTA, it keeps, you know, most of the goods that flow between these three countries, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, tariff-free. So, you know, to sort of zoom in and look at examples from our region, I'm here in Sonora, which produces lots of stuff that gets shipped over the U.S.-Mexico border into Arizona. Things like metals and aircraft parts, but also tons of farms here that produce low-cost produce that gets shipped to Arizona and the rest of the U.S. And part of the reason that that produce, you know, stuff like cucumbers, peppers, tomatoes, is priced the way that it is because it enters the U.S. tariff-free. So, you know, one expert that I talked to put it this way. People in the U.S. have had this free trade relationship with Mexico and Canada for so long that a lot of people don't really even notice it or think about it anymore on their day-to-day. You know, she said to lose that would be pretty disruptive to a lot of our supply chains.
Very interesting. Well, you and I have talked before, Nina, about the unique way that President Trump has navigated his relationship with President Sheinbaum. They've had a relatively warm dynamic compared to his relationship with other U.S. trading partners. But we also know the president is coming off a serious rebuke of his trade policies at the Supreme Court. What has he said about the USMCA, and how do you imagine he and the administration are going to approach these negotiations?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, Trump's own administration actually negotiated this trade deal, the USMCA, that we have now. But during his campaign and during his first year in office, he sort of publicly flirted with this idea of leaving the treaty or completely redrawing it in some major way. Unlike NAFTA, USMCA has this clause that it needs to be reviewed every 6 years. And so now, this upcoming July, it's up for its first review. Mexico and the U.S. are set to start these talks next week. It's sort of kind of like preparatory work before any potential big renegotiation this summer. But it's still too soon to say how this will all pan out. You know, certainly all three countries are going to try to extract concessions and make the deal work for them.
Right.
We've seen, of course, very protectionist measures from the Trump administration, like you said, during his first year of his second term. Lots of new tariffs, some of which were recently struck down by the Supreme Court. But the goal of those tariffs, at least partially, is sort of to restore domestic manufacturing in the U.S. You know, we've heard Trump call for the return of auto making in the U.S., and many of those plants over the past 30 years have moved to Mexico.
So that gives us kind of a perspective on a lot of what's at stake here for President Trump in the United States. What is the significance of this deal for Mexico and its economy? And I guess while we're at it, what's at stake politically for President Sheinbaum?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this deal is huge in Mexico. Mexico's a pretty export-heavy economy, specifically exports to the U.S. So they're invested in keeping the USMCA intact. You know, the Mexican government recently consulted with these business leaders across its main sectors and found that more than 80% of them do have a favorable view of USMCA.
Wow.
But, you know, a complete dismantling of the USMCA would likely have consequences for a lot of people in Mexico, not just business owners, but farm laborers and factory workers, too. So, you know, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has a lot at stake in keeping the trade treaty in place.
An 80% approval rating, a rare sight in politics these days. Well, are there any clues, Nina, that you're looking for in the coming days in terms of how the sides are communicating?
Yeah, so right now the people talking are trade delegations from each country. They're going to most likely focus on sort of more in the weeds details like rules of origin for manufactured goods, that kind of thing. But in the Trump administration, a lot can ride on the president's personal relationships with other world leaders. And it's worth noting that Trump and, you know, Canada's Mark Carney have had a rocky relationship these past couple
they
months.
They certainly have.
But, you know, we've seen Sheinbaum's relationship with Trump, you know, has been a little bit different. It's actually mostly been pretty good. You know, we've seen Sheinbaum walking this fine line since Trump first said before his inauguration that he would put big tariffs on Mexico and Canada. She has to keep these lines of communication between her and Trump open without seeming to her constituents like she's pandering or catering to him. So she's taken what she calls a cabeza fría approach. She's keeping a cool head and just waiting for things to play out before reacting to them.
Right.
So far, you know, that's actually really seemed to work for her. Mexico did get slapped with some new tariffs for some things like steel and aluminum, but it was able to avoid a lot of the worst of Trump's tariff threats last year. And Trump also in the past has tied tariffs to other seemingly non-trade issues, primarily drug trafficking. So as we near the summer review period, we might see the Trump administration bring up cartels and fentanyl trafficking in these negotiations to try to get concessions from Mexico. You know, this is where Mexico's recent killing of that major drug lord, El Mencho, could prove helpful in negotiations. Mm. It's the sort of thing that Trump could look at and see a victory, or at least a Mexico that's willing to go to bat against cartels. You know, obviously, Sam, on the other hand, a lot can happen between now and July. So we could find ourselves in a completely different world by then. So, yeah, I have a feeling that I'll be back on to talk with you about this again soon.
Well, we will look forward to that. That is KJZZ's Nina Krivinsky reporting from Hermosillo. Nina, thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
For the last year or so here at the show, we've been exploring the relationship between men and masculinity. Since President Trump's re-election prompted a nationwide debate about gender, questions about how to define it and who gets to have resurfaced. There's been a particular focus on young men and their relationship to Christianity. Some surveys have shown Gen Z men seeking out churches in record numbers. And while the data on that is somewhat mixed, one thing is clear. A group of vocal Christian influencers is trying to capitalize on the perceived trend. One of them is based right here in Arizona. Dale Partridge is the pastor of Kingsway Bible Church in Prescott, and he also runs a series of seminars on masculinity at his website, manhood.org. Before he became a pastor, Partridge was an entrepreneur. He started a fitness company and a rock climbing gym, as well as an online sales business called Sevenly, which contributed a portion of each of its sales to charity. But these days, Partridge spends his days preaching at Kingsway, running his masculinity classes, and posting on X, where he proclaims himself a, quote, preacher of hard truths for American Christians. Many of his views blend Christian faith with extreme right-wing positions on culture and politics. As part of our ongoing series of conversations, attempting to understand the voices shaping the debate about masculinity, I spoke to Partridge recently, and I began by asking him if he thinks, as many on the right do, that manhood is in crisis.
There's a bit of an egalitarian aura in the world right now where everything wants to be the same. Everything wants to be flattened. We can all do the same thing, and we're all the same thing. And men don't need to feel like misogynists because they're taking leadership of their household, or, you know, a headship of their home, or caring and leading society. I always tell people I'm just a normal guy from like 1880, in the sense of my views.
Well,
if
before,
you look at,
can I ask you about that? Can I ask you about that? Because
yeah.
So far, the way that you have been talking about this is not necessarily religious or scriptural. those ideals that you're ascribing to gender, where do those come from for you? Are those religiously rooted? Yeah.
I mean, I think that no matter what, they're going to be rooted in some sort of worldview, right? So it's not whether we will be religious, it's which religion will we be. It might not be a religion like Christianity or Islam or Hinduism. It might be a religion of self. It might be a religion of secularism. It might be a religion of, you know, nationalism, whatever it may be. And so I think historically, Christianity has proven itself to produce the greatest nations, civilizations.
So let me just make sure I understand. You're saying that everyone on some level in your framing is religious. It's just a question of which faith you're choosing. And if I'm hearing you right, you're saying that it is the Christian faith that is superior in that hierarchy.
Yeah, I think the results are in.
So, you know, in reading up about you prior to the work that you're doing now, you were in the entrepreneurship space. I mean, I know you're still an entrepreneur, but it seems to me like when you were running the organization Sevenly, which was a company that you co-founded, if I'm not mistaken, that gave away, was it $7 of every purchase?
Product sold, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. In reading up about you then and in your various bios and things, it didn't seem to me that faith and spirituality were as much at the center of your identity.
Yeah, correct. I was young in my faith. I had been in the business space for some time. It landed me writing a book called People Over Profit. And that really was shifting me towards this view of really what matters. There's a culture war. I think it's ramping up. It has been ramping up, I think, since 2016. I think when Obergefell passed and homosexual marriage, and that started to change a lot of the societal infrastructure around sexual ethics.
But can I ask, Dale, was that something that offended you personally? Like, why was this issue so relevant for you?
Well, a few things. One, we want things to be according to what is right and wrong. And so when the scriptures speak about order or modesty or masculinity or femininity or marriage or any of these things are good, not because God's not the beneficiary of these things. We are.
But do you see that as contiguous with, I mean, because in your book, People Over Profit, one of the things that book is aiming to do, as you wrote at the time, is to map out a, quote, responsible and compassionate marketplace. And how do you square the idea of compassion with some of these things that you've just been saying, which imply that other faiths are lesser somehow?
Yeah, because think about it this way. You know, Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. The second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. A great way to love your neighbor is to make sure that your neighbor can't be naked outside. You know, I lived in Oregon, and I remember being at a coffee shop with my family and watching a whole bunch of people ride by on their bicycles completely naked in front of all my children. And I think that we're entering into a bit of a national crisis. I think the Charlie Kirk event was somewhat of a crossing of the Rubicon moment.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I'd like to come back to that. But let me get first to one of the ways that it seems you are engaging with this is you have this curriculum that you have built at manhood.org, where the description you have on the website is a 1-year program for men to build wealth, love their families, and leave a godly legacy. So tell me a little bit about the wealth piece of that. Why is wealth building the first thing in that list?
Yeah. So, you know, I have a lot of men in my world, and I've noticed that a lot of them are struggling financially. Obviously, it's a hard economic time.
Right. I mean, I agree with you about that, Dale, but I have to say, I mean, a full year of tuition for your program is $2,200.
Yeah. Well, so this is mostly for guys that already have a small business or already have you know, a good job and are trying to figure out how to go from, you know, 60 grand or 70 grand or 80 grand to, you know, 250,000 or to get up to a place, because this is a problem. Money's a tool, right? It could be used for evil. It could be used for good. And I would rather money in the hands of Christians than in the hands of people who hate God. Christians need to earn more so that they can give more, so that they can support the ministry of the church.
I know that the wealth building component of this is only one piece of it. Because you, I mean, some of the other core tenets here are holy ambition, health for high performers. And to be clear, you see those things as core to masculinity specifically.
Yes, I would say that they are core to masculinity. I
Because I mean,
think
I could
that,
also, just to say, I could also imagine women caring about all of those things.
yeah, they can certainly. Women are going to care about all those things, but in different ways, right? And so, men are designed naturally to lead. They're designed to build, to protect, to be these providers. And so, women are incredible administrators. They're incredible helpers. They're incredible nurturers. They have not felt free to be feminine. Feminism, in my opinion, this might sound harsh, it's generally women wanting not to just be treated like men, but to really act like men.
But what do you
I mean, you're actually.
say? What do you say to a woman who would hear you say that and assert the idea that it is not for a man to dictate what is in their nature to want or desire?
Well, I'd say that no one's forcing anybody to do anything.
But
And
you
so
are,
it's.
just to be clear, Dale, I mean, you are asserting that this is the superior worldview to which everyone else must submit.
Correct, but so is everybody else. So it's like it's politicized or be politicized.
But do you think feminism seeks to have the worldview you believe in submit to it? Because the
100%.
good implication of egalitarianism is live and let live, right? You can believe these things that you believe, and feminists and whoever else can believe what they believe, and there's room at the table for everybody.
But that's the myth, and we're realizing now that it's not sustainable.
But
It doesn't
how
work.
do you see us realizing that? Help me understand where you see that.
Yeah, so let me give you an example. So 3% of the population basically influenced and made the entire population culturally submit to them. We had the rainbow flag flown at the FBI headquarters.
You're saying
We had 30 days
you're
of.
saying you feel like queer people forced the rest of society to submit to them?
They're certainly on their way until I think there was a big pushback, and I think we've actually shifted the cultural tone.
But do you think
And
they were asking others to submit to them, or they were just asking for equal rights and protection under the law?
everybody is an evangelist, and you evangelize your worldview. And those worldviews, once they're evangelized, become politicized. And those politicized worldviews become morals. And those moral worldviews become religious. And those religious worldviews come and confront the way that I live. And different things that are happening to my towns and the naked people that are flying down the street.
But Dale,
Like these things don't stay
happens?
put.
I mean, by your logic, this very small percentage of the population is a threat to your way of life. So even if you buy that logic, why is the answer for that for you to be a threat to their way of life?
Because my way's right.
According to.
The scriptures. You have to understand that the way that a Christian thinks is a Christian goes, well, the church is the body of Christ, and the gospel is the means by which Jesus is conquering his enemies.
I have to say, it feels like we're a long way from compassion here.
I don't believe that you can persuade someone into the kingdom of heaven. I think that Jesus says, well, actually, it's Paul who says, faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of Christ. And so I think you preach the gospel that you need to submit to the Lord Jesus Christ. And the work of the church is a compassionate work because it's bringing order and beauty back to people's lives.
And we will have more of my conversation with Pastor Dale Partridge after the break. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how federal tariffs are impacting one local business. But first, we continue with my conversation with Dale Partridge, lead pastor at Kingsway Bible Church in Prescott. As Dale and I were speaking, and his views on manhood came into focus, I found myself reminded of many of the late Charlie Kirk's views on the subject. Like Kirk, Partridge views masculinity as ordained by an almighty God to be dominant and superior. But if that's true, I asked him, why is it also so easily threatened?
Yeah, I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said something like, Tolerance is a virtue of those men who do not have any conviction. There was, I think it was Winston Churchill who said, of the armies of World War II, he said something like, "We don't fight because we hate those in front of us, but because we love those behind us." The idea of being tolerant of evil is not good, righteous, loving, or compassionate.
But
We're using the tools.
this is where I get a little concerned, Dale, because, to go back to Charlie Kirk, I mean, we're obviously in a time of extreme political violence. And I guess what concerns me about some of the ways that you're talking about this in terms of the idea that this is a battle and that, you're fighting for the people behind you and the people in front of you are enemies and evil. I mean, there is a way in which that really foments a culture of confrontation that can lead to that kind of violence. So, I mean, do you think there is something about what you're calling for in manhood that needs to explicitly say that is not masculine, that violence should be off the table?
Well, physical violence certainly should be off the table unless it's forced upon you. The Bible certainly speaks that we are in a battle, that we need to wear the armor of God, and there's a spiritual war that is constantly happening around us. That spiritual war manifests in a variety of ways in politics and culture, and so the Bible does certainly support a spiritual war. I do think that there's been a war going on for a long time. There's just been one side fighting, and that's been the left. And so I think that the right is finally waking up and going, "Oh, there's a war, and we actually need to get engaged now." Now, again, this war is an ideological war at the most part. It's a cold war, right? It's not a hot war. Hot war is when
Well,
now there's been some gun,
until
there's been
people
some
like,
gunfire.
there certainly has.
And so, but the way that the only way that this could really escalate, right, in terms of getting into more shootings, assassinations, all that kind of stuff. I think that's just going to be, this is, Sam, the result of multiculturalism.
Is it the result of multiculturalism or is it the result of Christianity calling multiculturalism evil?
Liberalism calls Christianity evil,
Does it?
right? But again, oh yeah. I mean, go to my Twitter feed and just look at the comments. I mean, I'm getting thousands of threats a month. And so, it's an all-out ideological warfare right now. And there's different places of the battle, right? So you want to get to the heart of it, where there's a lot of heat and a lot of conflict. You get down when you're talking about issues like Charlie Kirk was. There's a lot of risk there. And I think the Lord calls a variety of people into different spaces in that war. But you got to figure out, Sam, what side is right? And based off of what? By your emotions, by your intuition, by your own intellect? Like, what standard says that what you're doing is right? And so,
But
again,
that
I
to me,
really.
Dale, is where we get back to the problem, right? Is that people who are not believing Christians would look at what you just said as that is you basing it on your own instincts, your own emotions, your own opinions, because there is no proof that Christianity is the gospel, just as there is no proof that Islam is the gospel or any other faith that we could name.
Well, there is proof and there is fruit. I think, again, when I said earlier is that when you have a beautiful, when you have a civilization, I mean, you're still riding the coattails of a Christian civilization right now. And again, what we see is that, like, for example, with Islam, they're very intentional about taking over the political, cultural reality.
But again, Dale,
Don't
you're
push.
talking about being intentional about Christianity taking over the political and
I
cultural
am.
reality.
I know, I don't know why you're not understanding this, is that we both are. That's the war. That's the battle. And the conversation, I think, is very important. And I think there's not going to be much room for the middle anymore.
Well, I think we can certainly agree that, in your words, the conversation is important. So thank you for talking to me about this, Dale. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was great. And I appreciated the questions, even though they were pushing against it. I think it's a good conversation to have.
I've been speaking with Dale Partridge, who is pastor at Kingsway Reformed Church in Prescott. Dale, thanks again.
Thank you.
Native American tribes across the West are trying, and in more and more cases succeeding, in getting ancestral lands back. It's called the Land Back Movement, and our next guest describes it as tribal communities and activists trying to reclaim and reacquire land that was historically and culturally theirs. Chad Bradley is a freelance journalist and former Indigenous Affairs Fellow at High Country News. He and a colleague recently chronicled this effort. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about what they found, and they started with whether tribes are having more success getting their land back in the past few years than they have in the years prior.
I would say that there's been more progress, yeah, for sure, especially with the – I would say that there's more persistence both on the activist side, so on the lower grassroots community level, but also definitely on the larger like federal side, especially for tribal communities and stuff who – over time have been able to acquire, I guess, more influence and more say-so in their matters. So I think especially I think it has grown.
Any senses like why that is or how that's happened?
I think the reason why it just feels so, you know, I'm Native American myself. I'm a member of the Navajo Nation. And I think just from decades of trying to kind of reclaim a lot of our own indigenous ways of life and ways of thinking, especially after being, you know, subjected to what contemporary modern American society has been for centuries now. They're just continuing to work and move back toward the way that we used to live. So I think we've become more educated, more empowered, and continue to move toward that.
What are some of the ways that tribes are going about doing this, like trying to get land back that had been theirs that at some point in the past became not theirs?
I think the most substantial way is going through sort of like a government-to-government interaction where a federally recognized tribal nation is in a negotiation with either a state or the federal government to try to actually straight up buy it.
Hmm.
To buy these lands back. And they've seen success in that. And I think also there's been several pieces of, you know, federal legislation over the decades that kind of work toward that, particularly in Alaska.
Facilitate a tribe being able to buy back its land?
Yeah, yeah. And not just straight up buy, but just kind of over time give that, just essentially give that back.
I suppose, though, that if a tribe is going to buy that land back, it has to have the money to do that, right? Like are there tribes that are not in the financial position to be able to do that?
Yeah, certainly. There's nearly 600 federally recognized tribal nations here in the U.S. that are, you know, able to – but by and large, there's maybe barely a handful that have the influence and have, you know, the capital or the funds to be able to do that. So I think there's a lot of – tribal nations, most of them, that aren't able to do that. So perhaps they have to rely on, you know, other ventures, maybe straight up people donating to their cause, or maybe even some of the land that was in possession by federal government or from even private landowners will basically just give it back to them.
Hmm.
So It varies, but by and large, most tribes don't have the size, enrollment size, land-based size, or even the money to be able to do that.
You mentioned that, you know, this was something that happened in Alaska. You wrote about how, you know, some tribes in California have had some success with getting land back that had historically and traditionally been theirs. How about Arizona tribes? How is it going for them here?
For that particular story, I think in the examples that we looked at, you know, there was more straightforward examples in California, in Nevada, in the Dakotas. For here in Arizona, what I wanted to look at was efforts to try to protect and preserve, because that's also the other portion of land back. It's not just the goal is to get the actual physical pieces of land back, right? But it's more to also protect and preserve what, you know, might not actually physically technically belong to a community or a tribe. That's the case with a lot of reservations. The land doesn't belong to the tribe. It belongs to the federal government in the end. It's trust land. And so the extension to where they're trying to protect and preserve lands is also a part of land banking. And so for here in Arizona, a prominent example is Oak Flat,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is in jeopardy of being turned into a copper mine. And so they've been advocating for years to try to preserve that because that land is important to the San Carlos Apache and the Apache people.
And that's a pretty high-profile example of where the tribe, so far at least, has not been able to get its land back or, as you just referenced, even stop something from happening on it that they don't want to happen on it.
Yeah, that's been a long-standing fight, and especially with the current federal administration, with Trump wanting to, you know, ramp up the domestic energy and resource development here in the country, a lot of those – It's just another hurdle that has come up in this long, years-long battle that the tribes have been going through.
Is there an expectation that tribes will continue to push for getting this land back? That like this is a movement that's not going anywhere for a while?
Yeah, I think they will continue to, you know, be resilient and showcase their courage and keep advocating for themselves and their community. So I don't think that's going to go away as long as there are, you know, indigenous people.
What is the significance of tribes getting this land back?
It's definitely, because I've thought about this so much, because me being not just a, you know, a journalist who covers indigenous communities, but being an indigenous person myself,
mm-hmm.
when I think about the significance of all this, it's just it has to do with continue to live and persevere despite what has happened before us. Not so much remaining in the circumstances of our upbringing, right? Of the history of assimilation and colonization and things like that have ultimately changed the trajectory of my people and so many other communities for the worse, but if not for the better as well. So I think the significance is just to keep reminding people that, oh, we're still here. That's a big mantra from indigenous people, is to say, oh, we're still here. We still remember our language. We still remember where we come from. We still are still in charge of, you know, our destiny, and to try to kind of reclaim, relearn, and keep going as who they originally were.
It kind of sounds like what you're saying is you're using the past, and these lands help you use the past to maybe look to the future and help write the future a little bit.
Yeah. Yes, that's a good way to put it. There's a sort of continuity with the past and with where they're from, where they happen to come up from. In a lot of communities where they happen to reside, it's like we emerge from here, right? We emerge for Navajo people, you know, it's like we emerged from a couple previous worlds and we merged up in this area. So it's like this is integral to who we are. And a lot of indigenous mantra, too, is like we have to be good stewards and good managers of the land, and we have to, you know, protect it and care for it. So, again, it's just to keep trying to do that.
All right. That is freelance journalist Chad Bradley. Chad, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. In presidential campaigns, candidates live in fear of the dreaded October surprise, an embarrassing news story that breaks in the closing days of the campaign, dominating headlines and potentially costing the frontrunner a victory. In recent years, that same phenomenon has begun to haunt Hollywood's annual Oscar race. Last year, revelations about the use of AI during the production of The Brutalist were considered by many to have knocked the film off the inside track to Best Picture. And this year, for a couple of acting frontrunners, the cows, or perhaps the cats, are coming home to roost. Joining me now is KJZZ's resident culture expert, Amanda Kerberg. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
So why are we talking about cats here in the closing days of Oscar voting?
Okay, so the person who's considered the far and away frontrunner for the Best Actress award this year is Jessie Buckley, incredible Irish actress, for her performance in Hamnet. And a clip from an interview on the press circuit back in November with she and her co-star Paul Mescal actually emerged and went viral just this month, in which she's asked about her opinions on cats, and she and Paul both say they do not like cats. And she is much more strident about it, even had her now husband get rid of his two cats before they moved in together.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, this she's, of course, not alone in this. There's also been a bit of controversy regarding Mr. Timothy Chalamet.
Yes.
What did he say?
Oh, Chalamet said that pretty much nobody cares about opera and ballet anymore. And he did that in an argument for We Need to Save Cinema, which.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a rough one. You know, I would say, like, maybe Oscar nominees need to stop having hot takes, particularly this close to the Oscars. But, you're getting your name out there.
Sure. I mean,
going viral is creating a buzz. So that could be seen as some kind of campaign.
Sure, I guess. No such thing as negative press.
Yeah,
perhaps?
I believe that's not true in the digital age anymore. But you know what? Maybe I'm wrong.
So how did this, let's make sure we close the loop on this. How did this cat discourse resolve itself, if it has?
You know, it's still definitely, there's still a little touch of controversy. I will say Chalamet really coming in with the anti-opera, anti-ballet helped move the cat discourse along.
Okay.
But Jesse Buckley has since come out and said, you know, I actually love cats. Maybe just these cats specifically were bad cats, not all cats.
Hashtag not all cats.
Yes, exactly. Dochi is sticking by her guns that cats are fundamentally unfriendly animals, and we're all of us cat owners, me included, are in some ways lying to ourselves. But yeah, I think this is a fun one because it is really the core, most ancient personality test is, are you a cat person or are you a dog person?
Well, yes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe post, are you a hunter or are you a gatherer?
Right. So phase one, phase two.
Yes.
Well, let's just talk for a second, Amanda, about I think maybe for some listeners, the idea that Oscar campaigns are in fact campaigns might be somewhat unfamiliar. I mean, one of the reasons, right, that we have actors this late in the game continuing to go out on the press circuit and give interviews is because they know that people are still voting. And in some cases, the voters may not have watched their movies yet.
Yes. In alarmingly many cases. Yeah, it's only in April 2025, actually, that they instituted the rule for this next season that all voters in a category were required to watch the movies they're voting on. All of the movies, which, yeah, now these days in the Best Picture category, that's up to 10
films. Bunch of movies, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of movies, and I get these are busy people, but if you are voting in a category, I think we all agree you should have seen the film.
One would hope.
But yeah, I mean, even that is policed a little bit on an honor system, so we'll see how that goes. But yeah, campaigning for Oscar nominations has been a huge thing throughout the history of Hollywood and awards, with a number of controversies, bribery. Harvey Weinstein actually is one of the reasons we have a lot of the rules that we do have because of aggressive campaigning, gifts, lavish parties. You're not allowed now to even ask someone for their vote. And then the shift we had recently was just a couple of years ago, Andrea Riseborough had a really, really surprising nomination. And a lot of journalists hadn't even heard of the indie film To Leslie that she was nominated for. And it turned out that they had pretty much just, you know, gotten a lot of buzz from celebrities who knew her and were her friends, like people like Cate Blanchett, who got online and said, go see this performance. Academy voters, go see this performance.
Right.
And they decided to walk back even social media rules now. So you're not even really supposed to tag voters.
Wow.
I mean, there's like so little you can do, which is why I'm starting to rethink maybe, maybe a controversy at least is getting people in the mind of voters.
Right.
Yeah.
A hate watch is still a watch. Well, let's go back to this cat thing just momentarily, because as you pointed out, this is one of the oldest debates in culture. And it's also one of the oldest hot button conversations on the internet, right?
Yes.
Don't mess with cats.
Don't mess with cats. No, that's considered rule zero of the internet. Because if you think about like who are the early adopters of online technologies, who was getting online, you know, on the Usenet boards, like you have a lot of, let's say, cat people, a lot of like computer engineers, academics, journalists, a lot of like indoor people who are working on their computers and maybe not going out to walk the dog. It's funny because there is a little like correlation, not causation here, because like cat people tend to overlap with a lot of like kind of studious indoor activities, urban centers versus suburbs. So there is also a documented political bent in Cat People versus Dog People. But online, yeah, if you think of like how that was established, those early memes we were sharing, those were cat memes. If you ask Tim Berners-Lee, creator of the World Wide Web, like, what's the thing that surprised you most? He didn't say many of the frightful things you might have thought he would say. Instead, he said, like, all of the kittens.
Right, right, right. Well, and there are plenty of people who tune their algorithms when they're feeling stressed out about politics in the news to just show them pictures of cats.
Exactly. There's been academic research done on this, that cat videos give us positive emotions. They give us a boost of energy. Yeah, yeah, they're great.
Well, in the last 20 seconds or so here, Amanda, we should also talk about the different relationship between cats and dogs and movies.
Yes. Okay. So dogs have had such success in Hollywood that they even have their own award at the Cannes Film Festival, which is called the Palm Dog Award. So if you think of that, like Little Terrier and The Artist, that was one of the winners of the Palm Dog. Whereas cats, you know, I think we think of them as sometimes showing up on the lap of a Bond villain.
Right. Or Don Corleone.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Whereas dogs really teach a character about their humanity. Yeah. So give Jack Nicholson a dog. Things are going to go well.
Well, that is KJZZ's culture expert, Amanda Kerberg, breaking things down for us. Amanda, thank you.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a stinging ruling against President Trump's tariffs because he had imposed them using an emergency powers law. But the president responded in turn, announcing he would impose a blanket 10% tariff on all imports, citing a different law. Now, two dozen states, including Arizona, are suing over it. But regardless of what laws are being cited to impose tariffs, they have hit many small businesses hard. Multiple studies have shown the costs of tariffs are being passed on to U.S. consumers and businesses. And our next guest this morning says his local business has felt the effects firsthand. John Prisible is the owner of Proof Bread and told our co-host Lauren Gilger the tariff costs stopped them from opening a new location in Gilbert.
Yeah, we actually had to back out of a lease that we had already signed because the costs related to construction had more than doubled from the time that we had signed our lease in late 2024 to the time that the building was ready for us to renovate and make into a bakery location. Yeah, that was about a 1 year gap. And in that year, you know, the tariff policies hit, namely against construction materials. That was a pretty heavy sector that was hit by tariffs. So it materially changed the cost of beginning a new bakery from that state and made a project that we had already invested a substantial amount into untenable financially.
So it sounds like this is part of it, this, you know, basic supply of construction goods, things like that. But on the other side, you've also seen increases in prices of imported ingredients that you need, like wheat, flour, things like that.
Well, I think that's where, look, we are definitely impacted by tariffs as a bakery, although compared to many other small businesses that have supply chains that come from further away or have distribution chains that, you know, might be far away. I think shipping in general, which we have a little bit of exposure to, this was all heavily impacted by tariffs. And it goes to sort of the other half of the discussion is that having a local business means that we are a bit more resilient to what happens internationally further away because you know, our wheat supply chain is hyper local, but that doesn't mean that some of the inputs that, you know, our farmers use aren't impacted by the tariffs as well.
So there is a ripple effect down the line, even to the growers, it sounds like.
Yeah. So even in a hyper local business, like a bakery that mills its own flour and partners with farmers here in Arizona across a couple counties, we still will be hit by this in sort of unexpected ways because some input that one of our suppliers needs in order to do their job is affected by the tariffs. And so, you know, it has an inflationary effect on the business, which definitely changes the calculus on when we, you know, invest huge amounts of capital into a new bakery, but also impacts our ability to hold our prices firm.
Yeah, yeah. So you've also had to raise prices because of these kind of global and international economic shifts, which seems so, I guess, counterintuitive because, as you say, you're such a hyper-local business. But what went into that decision? Like, you wrote to your customers when you raised prices that you're navigating this challenging economic climate, but you know that customers are too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think ultimately we have a challenging responsibility in the sense that we legitimately feed the community. We serve about 7,000 families a week. And, you know, if a loaf of bread is 10 servings of food, you can sort of do the math and see we're serving tens of thousands of servings of food every single week out of our bakery. So it's a big responsibility in feeding a city. At the same time, we have a responsibility to our staff. And these rising costs rise for everybody. It's not just for the business. It's, yes, it is for our customers. It's also for our teams. And so, you know, we have to be very careful about the decisions we make so that the bakery can be sustainable, so we can keep paying our staff fair wages, mm-hmm. So that there can be some sort of affordability in our entire community. And so it's striking a balance. And yes, you know, we're transparent with our customers. When we have to make a move like this, we are legitimately asking for our customers to trade a little bit more of their precious resources in funds in order to make sure our business can continue to feed the community.
So where do things stand now for you, John? Like, the Supreme Court struck down the president's tariff structure, and it sounds like at this point, at least, he's replaced him with a blanket 10% tariff across most imports that could go up. But is this still impacting the business? Was the Supreme Court decision good news for you?
I think it's hard to really know what to put faith in, because the information sort of coming at us is, you know, different depending on which, you know, government body. It's confusing and conflicting information. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose on this end, we just have to see what will shake out. At Proof, we have a core value of one of our core values is resilience. And I think it's because since the beginning, we, you know, yes, we've experienced a lot of growth. Growth isn't easy. It comes at a cost when you're growing from a hand mixed operation with very rudimentary tools to, you know, a bakery spanning multiple locations. There's a lot to buy along the way, a lot to invest in, a lot of new people to employ, new systems to create. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of problems along the way. And I think we treat this like the many problems we face on a daily basis, albeit, you know, it's an unfortunate instability that seems, from my lens, avoidable.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. That is John Prizabal, the owner of Proof Bread, joining us. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for taking the time to talk this through. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, you just heard John Prizabal say, it's hard to really know what to put faith in. A good way of encapsulating a lot of what we talked about on today's show. We thank you so much for listening along with us. Don't forget that you can follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show, and that you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. Don't forget to join us again tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., where we will consider many more things, as we always do. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Thanks again for joining us. We'll talk to you then. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.